Elise affirmed with a smile.
I must step out also. I need to ask Skelly where she stored the last barrel of sugar.
She looked at Spark.
I'll count on you to brew the tea when the water boils. It's in the box on the shelf by the window.
Thank you, Lady Elise. I shall do so.
Oh, Lady Elise!
Her cheeks went pink and she laughed.
I haven't been a lady for years. I'm just Elise. If I forget to address you as the grand folk you are, you'll have to excuse me. I'm afraid my Bingtown manners have faded after nearly a score of years on the river.
We laughed and all assured her that we were comfortable. And we were. I felt more at ease on Tarman than I had in the Dragon City. The opened door let in a gust of river wind and then slammed shut behind her. We were left to ourselves, and I heard Amber breathe a soft sigh of relief.
Do you think they'd mind if I went on deck and had a look about?
Per asked wistfully.
I'd like to see how the tiller works.
Go, I said. They'll tell you if you're in the way, and if they tell you to move, do it fast. It's more likely they'll find some work for you to do. Lant unfolded himself as the boy stood.
I'll keep an eye on him. I'd like to have a look about myself. I've been out fishing with friends on Buckkeep Bay, but never on a river, let alone one so large and swift.
Will you still want tea?
Spark asked them, for the kettle had begun to steam.
Most likely. I think it's pretty cold out there, with the wind and all.
And again the wind slammed the door as they left.
What an odd little family we've become.
Amber observed as Spark took down a lovely sea-green pot for the tea. She smiled and added,
No tea for me. I'm content with the coffee. It's been years since I've had good coffee.
If this is good coffee, I dread what bad coffee might be, I told her. I did as I'd seen Elise do, dumping my unwanted cupful back into the big black pot on the stove. I waited for the tea to brew. We settled easily into life aboard ship and found a new rhythm to our days. The crew was happy to take Perseverance in and give him small tasks. When our lad was not learning his knots from Belin, a large and near-silent woman who could manage a deck pole as well as any man, he was put to polishing, sanding, oiling, and cleaning. He took to it as a duck to water and told me one afternoon that if he were not sworn to me, he could be happy as a ship's boy. I felt a twinge of jealousy, but also relief to see him busy and happy. Motley had joined us as soon as Tarman cast off from Kelsingra. The crow got over her wariness quickly and shocked all of us by preferring a perch on the bow rail. The first time she squawked, Tarman! Tarman! She won the heart of the crew and made Perseverance beam with pride. She became a cheery presence on the boat if the weather was blustery. She happily rode on Per as he went about his tasks, but whenever Lady Amber emerged onto the deck, Motley transferred to her. The crow had learned to chuckle and had an uncanny ability to laugh at just the right moment. Her gift for mimicry had become suspiciously good, but whenever I reached toward her with the wit, I found only the bland fog of a creature who was proudly uninterested in forming a bond. "How much do you understand?" I demanded of her one afternoon. She cocked her head at me, met my gaze, and demanded,
"How much do you understand?"
With a chuckle, she took flight downriver ahead of Tarman. Travel aboard a vessel is either boring or terrifying. On Tarman, I was glad to be bored. The farther away from the city, the less the skill current pressed on my walls. Each night, the tillerman steered us into moorage along the riverbank. Sometimes there was a beach, and we could disembark, but often we were nudged up against a bank of trees with serpentine roots. On the third day, the river narrowed and deepened and the current became much stronger. The forest closed in and there was no true horizon. The banks of the river were solid walls of trees with stilt roots, and we moored to them at night. It began to rain and didn't stop. Motley moved into the galley. I moved between our cramped cabin and the ship's steamy galley. My clothing and bedding were always slightly damp. I tried to pass my time constructively. Amber suggested I learn Mersin, the old language of Clerys.
Most people will speak common to you, but it's useful to know what they say to one another when they think you can't understand them.
To my surprise, my companions joined in. In the long, wet days, all of us would hunch on the cramped bunks while Amber would drill us in vocabulary and grammar. I had always been adept at learning languages, but perseverance outshone me. Lant and Spark struggled, but we pressed on. I put Lant to helping Perseverance with his letters and numbers. Neither of them relished those tasks, but they made progress. In the evenings, after we were moored, Lant, Spark, and Perseverance would join the crew in games that involved dice, cards, and some little carved rods. Imaginary fortunes changed hands often across the table. While they gamed, Amber and I convened in her cabin. I valiantly ignored the small smiles that Leftrin and Elise would exchange when I rejoined the company. I wished I could find humor in them, but in truth, I felt as if I tormented the fool during our private sessions. He wanted to help, but the viciousness he had endured at Clara's made it hard for him to speak his memories in a coherent order. The scalding anecdotes I pried from him only made me reluctant to dig deeper, and yet I knew I must. I learned of the four in bits and references. It was the best he could offer me. The only one of the four I learned about in detail was Capra. Capra seemed to take pride in being the eldest of the four. She had long, silver hair and wore blue robes weighted with pearls. She appeared gentle, kind, and wise. She had been his mentor when he had first arrived at Clara's. In his early days there, he was invited daily to her tower room after he had completed his lessons. There they would sit together on the floor before her fire while he scribed his dreams onto thick, soft paper that was as yellow as a daisy's heart. They shared delicious little cakes, exotic fruits and cheeses. She taught him about wines with tiny sips from little gold-rimmed goblets and educated him on teas. Sometimes she invited tumblers and jugglers there, simply to entertain him, and when he wished to join in, she had them teach him their skills. She praised him, and he blossomed in her care. When she spoke his name, Beloved, he believed she meant it. He spoke of an adolescence I envied, pampered, praised, educated, any child's dream. But we all wake from dreams. Most often, I sat on the floor of our cabin, and he claimed a lower bunk and stared sightlessly up as he spoke. Rain spattered on the small windows of the cabin. A single candle he could not see gave me a dim light appropriate to his dark tales. He was the fool in those sessions. In a loose blouse, with a spill of lace down his chest and plain black leggings, Amber's gown a wilted flower on the cabin's floor. His posture and garments were similar to when we had been youngsters, knees drawn up to his chin, one bared hand and one gloved hand clasped around his knees. His unseeing eyes stared at a distant time.
I studied hard to please her. She gave me dreams to read and listened to my earnest interpretation. I was sitting before her fire when I first read of the unexpected sun in an old and crumbling scroll. It spoke to me as no other had. I literally began to tremble. My voice shook as I told her of a childhood dream. My dream and the old one fit together like interlaced fingers. I spoke true to her, saying I'd be sorry to leave her, but I was the white prophet for this time. I knew that I needed to be out in the world, preparing for the changes I must make. Fool I was indeed, fearing I would hurt her by leaving.
The fool made a small sound.
She listened to me. Then she shook her head sadly and gently said, "You are mistaken. The white prophet for this time has already manifested. We have trained her, and soon she will begin her tasks. Beloved, every young white wishes to be the white prophet. Every student at Clary's has made that claim. Do not be sad. There are other tasks for you, to do humbly and well to aid the true white prophet." I could not believe what I was hearing. My ears rang, and my vision swam to hear her deny me. But she was so wise and kind and old. I knew she must be right.
I tried to accept that I was wrong, but my dreams would not let me. From the time she denied me, my dreams came on like a storm, 2 and 3 a night. I knew as I wrote them down that she would be displeased, but I could not hold them back. She took each one and showed me how it did not apply to me, but to another.
He shook his head slowly.
Fitz, I cannot explain my distress. It was like looking through badly made glass, eating rotten meat. There was a foulness to her words that made me feel physically ill. They ran wrong in my ears. But she was my mentor. She treated me so lovingly. How could she not be right?
He asked that question so earnestly. His hands, gloved and bared, needed each other. He looked away from me as if I could read anything in his shuttered eyes.
One day, she took me up the steps to the top tower room. Fitz, it was huge, bigger than the Queen's Garden at Buckkeep Castle, and it was littered with treasures, amazing things, objects that were lovely beyond imagining, scattered like discarded toys. There was a staff that gleamed with light all along its length, and a marvelous throne made from tiny interlocking flowers of jade. Some I know now were of elderling make. Wind chimes that sang, a statue of a pot with a plant that grew from it, flowered, faded back into the soil and then grew again. I gazed in wonder, but she told me crisply that they came from a faraway beach where such treasures washed up, and that the stewards of that place had bargained with her that all the sea gave them would be hers if she granted them a boon. I wanted to know more of that story, but she took my hand and drew me to the window and bade me look down. I saw a young woman below in a walled garden full of flowers and vines and fruit trees. She was white as I was white. I had met others at Clarys who were almost as colorless as I was. Almost. They had all been born there, and they all seemed to be related, sister to brother, cousin and uncle. But none of them were white as I was white. Not until I saw her. Another woman was there, with red hair and a great sword. She was teaching the pale woman how to wield it as a serving maid watched and cried encouragement. The white woman danced with that sword, and her hair floated as she moved so beautifully. Then Capra said, "There she is, the true white prophet. Her training is almost complete. You have seen her. Let us have no more of foolishness."
He shuddered.
That was the first time I saw the pale woman.
He fell silent. "You have told me enough for tonight." He shook his head, his mouth pursed tight shut. He lifted his hands and rubbed his face hard, and for a moment the faded scars stood out against his skin.
"So I didn't speak of my destiny again," he said harshly. "I wrote down my dreams, but I no longer tried to interpret them. She took them from me and set them aside. Unread, I believed."
He shook his head.
"I have no idea how much knowledge I handed over to her. By day I studied, and I tried to be content. I had a lovely life, Fitz. All that I could ask for. Good food, attentive servants, music and amusements in the evening. I was useful, I thought, for Capra put me to sorting old scrolls. It was a clerk's work, but I was good at it."
He kneaded his scarred hands together.
"In the way of my kind, I was still a child. I wanted to please. I missed being loved. So I tried. But of course, I failed. In my clerk's work, I encountered writings about the unexpected sun. I had a dream of a jester singing a silly song about fat suffices. He sang it to a wolf cub, Fitz. The cub had sprouting antlers.
He gave a muffled laugh, but the hair stood up on my arms. Had he truly seen me in a dream, so many years before we had even met? But it had not been me. It had only been a puzzle to which I was, perhaps, the answer.
Oh, I do not like this tale I vomit out to you. I wish I had not begun telling it. So many things we have never spoken about. So many things that shame me less if I am the only one who knows them. But I will finish.
He looked toward me, his sightless eyes swimming with tears. I slid across the floor and took his gloved hand in mine. His smile was a wavering thing.
I could not forever deny what I was. My anger and resentment grew. I wrote my dreams down, and I began to reference other dreams, some ancient, some recent. I built a fortress of evidence that Capra could not deny. I did not insist I was the White Prophet, but I began to ask her questions, and they were not innocent ones.
He smiled slightly.
I know you could never guess it, Fitz, but I can be stubborn. I was determined to force her to admit who and what I was.
Again he paused. I did not speak. This was like digging splinters out of an infected wound. He pulled his hand from mine and wrapped his arms around himself as if freezing.
I'd never been so much as slapped by my parents, Fitz. Not that I was a tractable and easy child. No, I am sure I was not. Yet they had corrected me patiently, and I had come to expect that from adults. Never had they denied me information as to why a thing was so. Always they had listened to me, and when I taught them something new, they were always so proud of me. I thought I was clever to ask Capra questions about my dreams and other dreams I had read. My questions would lead her to the inevitable answer that I was, indeed, the White Prophet. And so I began, a few questions on one day, a few more the next. But the day I asked Capra 6 questions in a row, all leading up to what she must admit about me, she held up her hand and said, "Not another question. I will tell you what your life is to be." Not even thinking, being young as one is only once, I said, "But why?" And that was it. Without a word, she rose and pulled a bell pull. Servant came, and she sent him for someone else, a name I did not know then. Kester. A very large and muscular man, and he came and held me down with a foot on the back of my neck and let his leather strap fall wherever it would on my body. I screamed and begged, but neither of them spoke a word. As abruptly as it began, my punishment was over. She dismissed Kester, seated herself at her table, and poured some tea. When I could, I crawled from her room. I remember my long trip down the stone stairs of her tower. The lash had fallen on the big muscles behind my knees and curled around one of my ankles. The tip of it had etched into my belly more than once. It was agony to try to stand. I edged down on my hands and knees, trying not to pull on the welts, crept to my cottage, and stayed there for 2 days. No one came. No one asked after me or brought me water or food. I waited, thinking someone would come. No.
He shook his head, old bafflement on his face.
Capra never summoned me again. She never spoke directly to me again.
He sighed out a small breath. In the silence that followed, I asked, "What were you expected to learn from that?" His tears scattered as he shook his head.
I never knew. No one ever spoke of what she had done to me. When 2 days had passed, I limped to the healer's room and waited for the full day. Others came and went, but he never summoned me. No one, not even the other students, asked what had happened. It was as if it had never occurred in their world, only mine. Eventually I began to limp to my lessons and to meals. But my instructors had a new disdain for me, rebuked me for my missed lessons, and punished me by withholding food. I was made to sit at the table and work on lessons while the others ate. It was on one of those days that I saw the pale woman again. She walked through the hall where we gathered for meals. All the other students looked at her with admiring eyes. She was garbed all in green and brown, like a hunter, and her white hair was braided back with golden thread. So beautiful. Her servant followed her. I think, looking back, I think her servant was Dwalia, the one who took B. One of the people who prepared our food hurried out and gave a hamper to Dwalia. Then the pale woman walked out of the hall with her servant carrying the basket. As she passed me, she halted. She smiled at me, Fitz. Smiled, as if we were friends. Then she said, "I am, and you are not." And she walked on, and everyone laughed. The twist to my mind and thoughts were worse than the welts all over my body.
He needed his silence for a time, and I let him keep it.
"So clever they are,"
he said at last.
"The pain they gave my body was only a gateway to what they could do to my mind. Capra must die, Fitz. The four must die to end the corruption of the whites."
I felt ill. Her servant was Dwalia, the same Dwalia that stole B.
"So I think. I could be wrong."
A question I didn't want to ask, an unwise question, found its way to my voice. "But after all that and all else you have told me, you went back with Prilcop?" He laughed bitterly.
"Fitz, I was not myself. You had brought me back from the dead. Prilcop was strong and calm. He was so certain that he could restore Clarice to its proper service. He came from a time when the word of a white prophet was a command to the servants. He was so certain of what we should do, and I had no idea what to do with this unexpected life."
I recall a similar time in my life. Burick made all our decisions.
"Then you understand. I couldn't think about anything. I just followed what he said we were going to do."
He clenched his teeth and then said,
"Now I go back for a third time. And more than anything, I fear that I will fall into their power again."
He took a sudden, gulping breath, but even so he could not seem to catch his breath. He began gasping like a spent runner. He could barely get his words out.
"Nothing could be worse than that. Nothing."
Hugging himself, he rocked back and forth on the bunk.
"But I must go back. I must."
He snapped his head back and forth wildly.
"Need to see,"
he cried out suddenly.
"Fitz, where are you?"
His gasping was even faster.
"Can't feel my hands."
I knelt beside the bed and put an arm around him. He yelped and struggled wildly, striking out at me. "It's me. You're safe. You're here. Breathe, fool. Breathe." I refused to let go. I was not rough, but I held him firmly. "Breathe."
"I can't."
"Breathe, or you'll faint. But you can do that. I'm here. You are safe." Suddenly he went limp and stopped fighting me, and very gradually, his breathing slowed. When he pushed me away, I let him. He folded himself tight and hugged his knees. When he finally spoke, he was ashamed.
"I never wanted you to know how much I feared to do this. Fitz, I'm a coward. I'd rather die than let them take me."
"You don't have to go back. I can do this."
"I do have to go back."
He was instantly furious with me.
"I must."
I spoke quietly. Then you will. With great reluctance, I added, I could give you something to carry with you. A quick end if you thought you would prefer that. His gaze wandered over my face as if he could see me. He said quietly,
You'd do it, but you'd not approve, nor have such a resource for yourself.
I nodded, then spoke. That's true.
Why?
Something I overheard a long time ago. It didn't make sense when I was younger, but the older I get, the wiser it seems. Prince Regal was speaking to Verity.
And you put weight on something Regal said? Regal wanted you dead. From the moment he knew of your existence, he wanted you dead.
True, but he was quoting what King Shrewd said to him. Probably the king's response when Regal suggested that killing me was the easiest solution. My grandfather told him, Never do what you can't undo until you've considered well what you can't do once you've done it. A slow, fond smile claimed his face.
Ah, that does sound like something my king would have said.
His smile widened, and I sensed a secret he would not share. Killing myself would put an end to all other possibilities, and more than once in my life, when I thought death was my only escape, or that it was inevitable and I should surrender to it, I've been proven wrong. And each time, despite whatever fire I had to pass through, I found good in my life afterward.
Even now, with Molly and Bee dead?
It felt disloyal, but I said it. Even now, even when I feel like most of me is dead, life breaks through sometimes. Food tastes good, or something Purr says makes me laugh. A hot cup of tea when I'm cold and wet. I've thought of ending my life, fool. I admit it, but always, no matter the damage to it, the body tries to go on, and if it manages to, then the mind follows it. Eventually, no matter how I try to deny it, there are bits of my life that are still sweet. A conversation with an old friend. Things I am still glad to have. He groped for me with his gloved hand, and I offered mine. He shifted his grip to a warrior's clasp, wrist to wrist. I returned the pressure.
It's true for me as well, and you are right. I would never have thought to admit it, even to myself.
He released my wrist and leaned back, then added,
But still, I would take your escape if you will prepare it for me, because if they do manage to take me, then I cannot.
His voice had begun to shake. I can prepare something for you. Something you could carry tucked in the cuff of your shirt.
That would be good. Thank you.
Of such cheerful discourse were my evenings made. I had not realized that we were on a tributary until we left it and joined the furious rush of the Rain-Wild River. The turbulent waters that carried us now were grey with acid and silt. We no longer drew water from the river, but relied only on our casks. Belin warned Perseverance that if he fell overboard,
All we might pull back would be your bones.
It did not dampen his enthusiasm at all. He scampered about the deck despite the rain and wind, and the crew tolerated him with good humor. Spark had less endurance for the foul weather, but she and Lant would sometimes stand on top of the deckhouse, sheltering under a square of tarpaulin, and watch the passing view as the current swept us along. I wondered what fascinated them, for the scenery had become unvarying. Trees. More trees, some of a size I had never imagined, with trunks as big around as towers. Trees made of 100 spindly trunks, trees that leaned and dropped extra trunks down from the branches into the river's marshy edge. Trees with vines climbing up them, trees with curtains of vines dangling down. I had never seen forest so thick and impenetrable, or foliage that could survive such wet conditions. The far shore of the river retreated to a foggy distance. We heard more birds during the day, and once saw a shrieking troop of monkeys. Very strange to me. It was all so different from the familiar landscapes of Buck. Even as it fascinated me and I longed to explore it, my deeper longing was for home. My thoughts went often to my nettle, gravid with her first child. I'd abandoned her when she was still growing within Molly to obey the urgent summons of my king, and now I left her to bear my first grandchild alone at the behest of the fool. How did Shade fare? Had he succumbed to age and a wandering mind? There were times when taking vengeance for the dead seemed too high a price for abandoning the living. I kept such musings to myself. My fears of Skilling lingered. The press of it I had felt in Kelsengrar had diminished, but the living ship beneath my feet was a constant hum of sentience against my walls. Soon, I promised myself, even a brief skill contact could convey so much more than the tiny lettering on a messenger bird's scroll. Soon. Once, when we were moored for the night, Skelly rose from the table, retrieved a bow and quiver from the crew quarters, and then stepped soundlessly onto the deck. No one moved until we heard her shout,
"I got a river pig! Fresh pork!"
There was a scramble to the deck, and the messy, exuberant work of retrieving the dead animal. We butchered him on the narrow mud beach. We feasted that evening. The crew built a fire, threw on green branches, and toasted strips of pig in the flames and smoke. The fresh meat put the crew in a merry mood, and Perseverance was pleased to be teased as one of their own. After we had eaten, the cook fire became a bonfire that drove back the darkness and the biting night insects. Lant went for firewood and returned with an armful of an early-blooming vine with fragrant flowers. Spark filled Amber's hands with some, and then crowned herself with a garland. Hennessy began a bawdy song, and the crew joined in. I smiled and tried to pretend I was neither an assassin nor a father mourning the loss of his child. But to join their simple, rowdy pleasure seemed a betrayal of Bea and how her little life had ended. When Amber said she was wearied, I assured Spark that she should stay with Lant and Purr and enjoy the evening. I guided Amber as we moved over the mucky shoreline to a rough rope ladder tossed over Tarman's side. It was a struggle for her to climb the sagging rungs in the long skirts she wore. "Would not it all be easier if you dropped the pretense of Amber?" She gained the deck and tousled her skirts back to order.
"And which pretense would I then assume?"
she asked me. As always, such words gave me a twinge of pain. Was the fool indeed only another pretense, an imaginary companion invented for me? As if he had heard my thoughts, he said,
"You know more of me than anyone, Fitz. I've given you as much of my true self as I dare."
"Come," I said, and took his arm for balance while we both shed our muddy footwear. Captain Leftrim was rightfully fussy about keeping the deck clean. I shook the mud from our shoes over the side and carried them as I guided him back to the cabin. From the shore came a sudden whoop of laughter. A whirl of sparks rose into the night as someone threw a heavy piece of wood onto the bonfire.
"It is good for them to have some enjoyment."
"It is," I replied. Childhood had been stolen from both Spark and Perseverance. Even Lant could use a window of merriment in his permanent wall of melancholy. I went to the galley to kindle a little lantern. When I returned to the cabin, the fool was already out of Amber's fussy dress and into his simpler garb. He had wiped the paint that composed her face onto a cloth and turned to me with his old fool's smile. But in the light of my small lantern, the tracks of his torment still showed on his face and hands as silver threads against his light skin. His fingernails had regrown thick and stubby. My efforts at healing and the dragon's blood he had taken had aided his body's recovery more than I had dared hope, but he would never be who he had been. But that was true of all of us.
"What are you sighing about?"
"I'm thinking of how this has changed all our lives. I was on the way to being a good father, fool, I think. Yes, burning bodies of murdered messengers at night. Excellent experience for a growing child."
"Yes, well."
He sat down on the lower bunk. The upper bunk was neatly spread up. The other two bunks seemed to be serving as storage for the excessive wardrobe that he and Spark had dragged with them. He sighed and then admitted,
"I had more dreams."
"Oh?"
"Significant dreams. Dreams that demand to be told aloud or written down."
I waited. And?
It is hard to describe the pressure one feels to share significant dreams.
I tried to be perceptive. Do you want to tell them to me? Perhaps Leftrin or Elise would have pen and ink and paper. I could write them down for you.
No!
He covered his mouth for a moment, as if the explosive denial had revealed something.
I told them to Spark. She was here when I woke in a terrible state, and I told her.
About the Destroyer? He was silent for a moment. Then...
Yes, about the Destroyer.
You feel guilty about that? He nodded.
It's a terrible burden to put on one so young. She already does so much for me.
Fool, I don't think you need be concerned. She knows that I am the Destroyer, that we are on our way to bring down all Clarys. Your dream just repeats what we all know. He wiped the palms of his hands down his thighs and then clasped them together.
What we all know,
he repeated dully.
Yes.
Abruptly he added,
Good night, Fitz. I think I need to sleep.
Good night, then. I hope your dreams are peaceful.
I hope I don't dream at all,
he replied. It felt strange to rise and leave him there, taking the lantern with me, leaving the fool in the dark, as he was always in darkness now. Chapter 10 B's Book. The preparation of the darts must be done with a steady hand. One cannot wear gloves, but one must be extremely cautious, for the smallest nick of the fingers will become infected immediately, and the parasites will quickly spread. There is no cure. I have found that using the eggs of the boring worms combined with the eggs of the ones that cling inside a man's guts and become long worms is the most effective in causing a prolonged and painful death. Eggs from one or the other will plague the victim, but not lead to death. It is the double attacks of these creatures that inflict the death most befitting the cowards and traitors who dare betray Clarys. Various devices of my own design. Kultry of the Four. After a few days aboard Tarmon, I had grown more accustomed to the light press of the ship's awareness against mine. I was still uncomfortable that a live ship would be privy to any message I might skill out. But after much debate with myself, I had decided to risk the contact with home. Lady Amber sat down on the ship's bunk opposite mine. A cup of tea steamed on the little shelf by the bunk. In the small space, our knees nearly touched. She gave a sigh, untwined a scarf from her damp hair, and shook it out. Then the fool reached up to tousle his hair into wild disorder that it might dry more quickly. It was no longer the dandelion fluff of his boyhood, or as golden as the Lord Golden's hair had been. To my surprise, white mixed with the pale blonde of it, like an old man's hair. White hair growing from the scars on his scalp. He wiped his fingers on Amber's skirts and gave me a weary smile. "Are you ready?" I asked him.
"Ready and well supplied,"
he assured me. "How will you know if I need your help? What will you do if I am swept away?"
"If I speak to you and you don't respond, I'll shake you. If you still don't respond, I'll dash my tea in your face."
I hadn't realized that was why you'd ask Spark for tea.
"It wasn't."
He took a sip from his cup.
"Not entirely."
"And if that doesn't bring me back?" He groped on the bunk beside him and held up a small pouch.
"Elf bark, courtesy of Lant. It's well powdered, to mix with my tea and pour down your throat, or simply stuff into your mouth."
He canted his head.
"If the elf bark fails, I will link my fingers to your wrist, but I assure you that will be my final resort."
"What if you do, and instead of you pulling me back, I drag you under?"
What if Tarman hits the rock and we all drown in the acid waters of the Rainwild River?
I stared at him in silence.
Fitz, get to it, or don't, but stop procrastinating. We are far from Kelsingra. Try to skill.
I centered myself and let my vision unfocus, evened my breathing, and slowly lowered my walls. I felt the sweep of the skill current, as cold and powerful as the river beneath our hull, just as dangerous. It was not the riptide it had been in Kelsingra, but I knew that it concealed hidden currents. I hesitated upon the brink, and then waded in, groping for Nettle. I did not find her. I reached for Thick. A distant wailing of music might have been him, but it faded as if wind had blown it away. Dutiful? Not there. I tried for Nettle again. I felt as if my fingers brushed my daughter's face and slid away. Shade? No. I had no desire to tatter away in the skill current alongside my old mentor. When last I had seen the old man, his moments of acuity had been brief islands in a sea of vagueness. His skill magic, once so feeble, now sometimes roared, and he used it without caution. The last time we had connected in the skill, he had nearly dragged me away with him. I must not try to reach for Shade. Shade seized me. It was like being grappled from behind by a boisterous playmate, and I was flung headlong into a wild rush of skill.
Oh, my boy! There you are! I've missed you so!
His thoughts embraced me in a tightening net of fondness. I felt myself becoming the person that Shade imagined me to be. Like clay pressed into a brick mold, the parts of me he'd never known were being sheared away.
Stop! Let me go! I have word for Dutiful and Nettle, news of Kelsingra and the dragon traders.
He chuckled warmly, yet I felt chilled at the soft press of his thoughts.
Leave that! Leave all that and join us here! There is no loneliness, no separation at all, no aching bones, no worn-out body. It's not what they told us, Fitz. All those warnings and dire predictions, fuh! The world will go on without us just as well as it did with us. Just let go!
Was it true? His words were soaked in conviction. I relaxed in his grip as the skill current roared past us.
We aren't tattering. I'm holding you tight, keeping you part of me. It's like learning to swim. You can't find out how until you're all the way into the water. Stop clinging to the bank, boy. You only tear apart when you try to hold on to the shore.
He had always been wiser than me. Shade had always advised me, educated me, and commanded me. He seemed calm and content. Happy, even. Had I ever before seen Shade content and happy? I moved toward him, and he embraced me more warmly. Or did the skill seize me? Where did Shade stop and the skill begin? Had he already drowned in the skill? Was he dragging me down to join him?
Shade! Shade, Falstar, come back to us! Dutiful, help me! He's fighting me!
Nettle gripped him and attempted to peel him away from me. I held to him fiercely, struggling to make her aware of me, but she was focused on separating us.
Nettle!
I roared my thought, trying to make it stand out from the rip and rush of thoughts around us.
Thoughts?
No, not thoughts. Being. Beings. I pushed all wondering aside. Instead of clinging to Shade, I thrust him toward her.
I've got him!
She told a dutiful I barely sensed, and then in sudden awe,
Da, are you here? Are you alive?
Yes, we are all fine. We'll send you a bird from Bingtown. Then, divorced from Shade, the surge of the skill began to tear at me. I tried to draw back, but the skill gripped me like a bog. As I struggled, it sucked at me, pulling me deeper. Beings. The current was a flow of beings, all plucking at me. I gathered my strength and flung myself against its current as I resolutely put up my walls. I opened my eyes to the blessedly cramped and smelly little cabin. I folded forward over my knees, gasping and shaking.
what?
The fool demanded. I nearly lost myself. Shade was there. He tried to pull me in with him.
What?
He told me that everything I learned about the skill was wrong, that I should give myself over to the skill. Just let go, he said. And I nearly did. I nearly let go. His gloved hand closed on my shoulder and shook me lightly.
Fitz, I did not think you had even begun to try. I told you to stop agonizing about it, and you fell silent. I thought you were sulking.
He cocked his head.
Only moments have passed since we last spoke.
Only moments? I rested my forehead on my knees. I felt sick with fear and dazed with longing. It had been so easy. I could drop my walls and be gone. Just gone. I'd merge with those other rushing entities and wash away. My hopeless quest would be abandoned, along with the loss I felt whenever I thought of B. Gone would be the deep shame, gone the humiliation that everyone knew how badly I had failed as a father. I could stop feeling and thinking.
Don't go,
the fool said softly. What? I sat up slowly. His grip tightened slowly on my shoulder.
Don't go where I can't follow you. Don't leave me behind. I'd still have to go on. I'd still have to return to Clarice and try to kill them all. Even though I would fail. Even though they would have me in their power again.
He let go of me and crossed his arms as if to contain himself. I wasn't aware of the connection I'd felt from his touch until he removed it.
Someday we must part. It's inevitable. One of us will have to go on without the other. We both know that. But Fitz, please, not yet. Not until after this hard thing is done.
I won't leave you. I wondered if I lied. I'd tried to leave him. This insane mission would be easier if I were working alone. Probably still impossible, but my failure would be less horrific, less shameful to me. He was silent for a time, looking into the distance. His voice was hard and desperate as he demanded,
"Promise me."
"What?"
"Promise me that you won't give in to Shade's lure. That I won't find you somewhere sitting like an empty sack with your mind gone. Promise me you won't try to abandon me like useless baggage, that you won't leave me behind so I'm safe, out of your way."
I reached for the right words, but it took me too long to find them. He did not hide his hurt and bitterness as he said,
"You can't, can you? Very well. At least I know my standing. Well, my old friend, here is something I can promise you. No matter what you do, Fitz, no matter if you stand or fall, run or die, I must go back to Clarice and do my best to pull it all down around their ears. As I told you before, with you or without you."
I made a final effort. "Fool. You know I am the best man for this task. I know that I work best alone. You should let me do this my way." He was motionless. Then he asked,
"If I said that to you, and if it were true, would you allow me to go alone into that place? Would you sit idly by and wait for me to rescue B?"
An easy lie. "I would," I said heartily. He said nothing. Did he know I lied? Probably. But we had to recognize what was real. He could not do this. His shaking terror had created serious doubt in me. If he succumbed to it in Clarice, I simply could not take him. I knew his threat was real. He would find his way there, with or without me. But if I could get there before him and do my task, if the deed was done, he'd have no quest. But would he ever forgive me? While I'd been silent, he'd stored the pouch of elf bark in his pack. He sipped from his cup.
"My tea's gone cold,"
he announced. He stood, cup and saucer in hand. He smoothed his hair and flounced his skirts into order, and the fool was gone. Amber trailed her fingers along the wall until she found the door, and then left me sitting alone on the narrow bunk. The fool and I had one serious quarrel on that journey. I came to Amber's cabin one evening at our agreed-upon time as Spark was leaving. Her face was pale and strained, and she gave me a tragic look as she left. I wondered if Amber had rebuked her. I dreaded finding him in a dark and irrational mood. Slowly, I closed the door behind me. Inside the room, yellow candles burned in glass, and the fool perched on the lower bunk. His grey woolen nightrobe had seen much wear, probably purloined from Shade's clothing stash. The shadows under his eyes and the resigned droop of his mouth made him older. I sat down on the bunk opposite him and waited. Then I saw my hastily stitched pack beside him. "What's that doing here?" I asked. For one moment, I thought that some accident had brought it to his room. He set a possessive hand on it and spoke hoarsely.
"I have promised to take all blame for this. Even so, I fear I may have broken Spark's friendship to do this. She brought it to me."
Cold spread out of my belly and through my veins. I made a conscious and difficult choice. No anger. Fury surged against my willful blocking. I knew, but still I asked. "And why would you ask her to do that?"
"Because Perseverance mentioned to her that you had books that belonged to B. Sometimes he saw you read what she had written there. Two books, one with a bright embossed cover and the other plain. He recognized her hand on the page when he climbed past you to his bunk."
He paused. I shivered with fear of how angry I might become. I controlled my breath, as Shade had taught me, the silent breathing of an assassin on the verge of a kill. I quenched my emotions. The violation I felt was too immense. The fool spoke softly.
"I think she kept a dream journal. If she is mine, if she carries the blood of a white, then she will dream. The drive to share those dreams, to speak or write them, would be overpowering. She will have done it. Fitz, you are angry. I can feel it like storm waves lashing my shores. But I must know what she wrote. You have to read these books to me, from start to finish."
"No." One word. For one word, I could keep my voice level and calm. His shoulders rose and fell with the strength of the breath he took. Did he struggle for control as I did? His voice was taut as a hangman's rope.
"I could have hidden this from you. I could have had Spark steal the books and read them to me here in stealth. I didn't."
I unclenched my fists and my throat. "That you didn't wrong me in that way makes this no less of an affront." He took his gloved hand from the bag. He put both his hands, palms up, on his knees. I had to lean closer to hear his whisper.
"If you think these the random writings of a small child, your anger is justified. But you cannot believe that. These are the writings of a white prophet."
He dropped his voice even lower.
"These are the writings of your daughter, Fitz, your little bee, and mine."
If he had struck me in the belly with a stave's end, the impact could not have been worse. "B was my little girl." It came out a wolf's growl. "I don't want to share her." Honesty can be like a boil that bursts at the most unfortunate time. Had I known the source of my anger before I spoke it aloud?
"I know you don't, but you must."
He set his hand lightly on the pack.
"This is all that she could leave for us. Other than one glorious instant of holding her and watching her promise explode all around me like a geyser of light into a dark night, it is all of her that I will ever know. Please, Fitz, please, give me that much of her."
I was silent. I could not. There was too much in those books. In her journal, there was too little mention of me and the days when she had held herself apart, too much of a small girl fighting alone the ugly, childish battles with the other Withywood's children, too many entries that made me feel cowardly and ashamed of what a blind father I had been. Her account of her clash with Lent and how I had promised her afterward that I would always take her part showed how I had failed in that regard. How could I read those pages aloud to the fool? How could I bear my shame? He knew I could not share those writings even before he had asked me. He knew me that well. He knew that there were some things I could not yield. Why did he even dare to ask? With both hands, he lifted the pack to cradle it to his breast. The tears started in his golden eyes and traced the scars on his face as they ran down his cheeks. He held out the pack, surrendering to me. I felt like a thwarted child whose parent gives in to his tantrum. I took the pack and immediately opened it. There was little in it save the books and Molly's candles. I had stowed most of my clothing, the Elderling firebrick, and other possessions in the tidy cabin cupboards. In the bottom, one of my shirts wrapped the tubes of dragon silver. I had judged my pack to be the most private place to keep such things. They were wrapped as I had left them. He had spoken true. He hadn't rummaged. A waft of fragrance rose to me. I breathed in Molly's perfumes from the candles. With them came calm. Clarity. I lifted the books out to shift the candles to a safer position. His words were hesitant.
I'm sorry if I've hurt you. Please, don't blame Spark or Perseverance. It was a chance remark on his part, and the girl acted under duress.
Molly's calmness, Molly's stubborn sense of fairness. Why was it so hard? Was there anything in those books that he did not already know about me? What could I lose? Was not all lost to me already? Did he not share that loss? Snow had dampened one corner of B's dream journal. It had dried, but the leather cover had puckered slightly, rippling the embossing. I tried to smooth it with my thumb. It resisted. I opened it slowly. I cleared my throat. On the first page, I said, and my voice squeaked tight. The fool looked blindly toward me, tears streaming down his cheeks. I cleared my throat again. On the first page, there is a drawing of a bee. It is exactly the size of a bee and exactly the colors of a bee. Above the bee, written very carefully in a sort of arc, are the words, "This is my dream journal of my important dreams." His breath caught in his throat. He sat very still. I stood up, crossing that tiny room, took less than 3 steps. Something, not pride, not selfishness, something I had no name for, made those 3 steps the steepest climb I'd ever attempted. I sat down beside him with the book open on my lap. He was not breathing. I reached across and lifted his bare hand by its woolen sleeve. I brought it over to the page and lightly skimmed the arch of letters with his drooping fingers. "Those are the words." I lifted again and maneuvered his forefinger onto the bee. "And here is the bee she painted." He smiled. He lifted his wrist to dash the tears from his face.
"I can feel the ink she put on the page."
Together, we read our daughter's book. It was still a barbed thought for me to name her so, but I forced myself to it. We did not read it swiftly. That was his decision, not mine. And to my surprise, he did not ask that I read her journal. It was her dreams he wanted to hear. It became our ritual as we parted each evening. A few dreams from her book read aloud. I read no more than 3 or 4 every night. Often I read each one over as many as 12 times. I watched his lips move silently as he committed them to memory. He smiled when I read a favorite dream of wolves running. A dream of candles made him abruptly sit up straight and then fall into a long and pensive silence. Her dream of being a nut puzzled him as much as it did me. He wept the evening I read her dream of the butterfly man.
Oh, Fitz, she had it. She had the gift, and they destroyed it.
As we shall destroy them, I promised him.
Fitz,
his voice halted me at the door.
Are we sure she is destroyed? You were delayed in the Skill Pillars when you travelled from Aslevyol, but eventually you emerged at Buckkeep.
Give up that hope. I was a trained skill user. I emerged. B went in untrained, with no experienced guide, part of a chain of untrained folk. So we know from Shun. There was no sign of them when Nettle's coterie went after her, no trace of them when we followed that same route, months later. She is gone, fool, tattered away to nothing. I wished he had not made me speak the words aloud. All that is left for us is vengeance. I did not sleep well on Tarman. It was, in some ways, like sleeping on the back of an immense animal and always being aware of him with my wit sense. Often I had slept with the wolf's back against my belly, but Night Eyes had been a comfort, for he shared his wild awareness of our surroundings with my duller human senses. I had always slept better when he was near me. Not so with Tarman. He was a creature apart from me. It was like trying to sleep with someone staring at me. I sensed no malevolence, but the constant awareness made me jittery. So it was that I was sometimes awake and restless in the middle of the night, or in the dark grey time that comes before dawn. Dawn was a strange thing on the rain-wild river. During the day, we travelled down a stripe of daylight in the centre of the river, while the looming trees to either side blocked both sunrise and sunset. But my body knew when it was dawn, and often I would wake in the pre-dawn and go out onto the still, damp deck to stand in the unsilence of the slowly waking forest that surrounded us. I found a small measure of peace in those hours, when I was as close to alone as one can be on a ship. There was always a hand on anchor watch, but for the most part, they respected my stillness. One such pre-dawn time, I was standing on the port side, looking back at the way we had come. I held a cup of steaming tea in my two hands, a welcome warmth. I blew on it softly and watched the shifting plumes of steam. I was about to take a sip when I became aware of a light footfall on the deck behind me. "Morning," I said quietly to Spark as she came up beside me. I had not turned my head to look at her, but if she was surprised at my awareness of her, she didn't show it. She came to stand beside me, resting her hands on the railing. "I can't say I'm sorry," she said. "I'd be lying." I took a sip of the tea. "Thank you for not lying to me," I said, and I meant it. Shade had always stressed that lying was an essential skill for any spy, and had required me to practice artificial sincerity. "Are you angry with me?" she asked. "Not at all," I lied. "I expect you to be loyal to your mistress. I'd mistrust you if you weren't."
"But don't you think I should be more loyal to you than to Lady Amber? I've known you longer. Shade trained me, and told me to listen to you."
"When he had to abandon you, you chose a new mentor. Be loyal to Lady Amber." I gave her a piece of truth. "It comforts me that she has someone as competent as you watching over her at all times." She was nodding and looking at her hands. Good hands. The clever hands of a spy or an assassin. I ventured a question. "How did you know about the books?"
"From Perseverance. Not that he thought he was betraying a secret. It was when you said we should all be learning. Per and I were talking later, and he said he did not like the sitting still and staring at paper part of learning to read. But he said that you had a book that B had written. She had taught him some of his letters, and he had recognized the book was hers by the way the letters were made. He mentioned it to me since he hoped that if he learned to read, he could someday read what his friend had written."
I nodded. I had never said to the boy that the books were private. He'd rescued one of them when the bear had wrecked our camp. He'd even commented on them. I could not blame him for telling Spark. But I found I could still blame her for locating the books in my pack and then taking it to Amber. Had she handled Molly's candles? Did she know of the tubes of silver in my socks? I did not say anything, but I think she still felt the rebuke.
"She told me where to look and asked me to fetch it,"
What was I to do?
What you did, I said shortly. I wondered why she had sought me out and begun this conversation. I had not rebuked her, nor treated her any differently since she had given my books to the fool. The silence grew long. I cooled the heat of the anger I felt, and suddenly it became cold, wet embers, drenched by my discouragement with our quest. What did it matter? Sooner or later the fool would have found a way to get at the books. And now that he had, it felt right that he know what was in B's dream book. There was no logic to me feeling angry or injured that Spark had facilitated it. But still. She cleared her throat and said, Shade taught me about secrets, how powerful they are, and how once more than one person knows the secret, it can become a danger rather than a source of power. She paused, then added, I know how to respect secrets that are not mine. I want you to know that. I know how to keep to myself secrets that do not need to be revealed. I gave her a sharp look. The fool had secrets. I knew some of them. Was she offering me some of the fool's secrets as a peace offering for her theft of B's books? It offended me that she thought I could be bribed with my friend's secrets. Chances were that I already knew them, but even if they were ones I did not know, I had no desire to gain them through her betrayal. I frowned at her and looked away. She was quiet for a time. Then she spoke in a carefully measured way, her voice resigned. I want you to know that I feel a loyalty to you as well. Not as great a connection as I feel to Lady Amber, but I know that you protected me as best you could when Lord Shade began to fade. I know that you put me with Lady Amber as much for my sake as for hers. I have a debt to you. I nodded slowly but said aloud, The best way you can repay me is to serve Lady Amber well. She stood silently beside me, as if she was waiting for me to say something more. When I didn't, she added with a small sigh, Silence keeps a secret. I understand. I continued to stare out over the water. This time, she ghosted away from me so softly that only my wit told me when I was alone again. On a clear, calm afternoon, we came upon a rain-wild settlement. The banks of the river had not grown any more welcoming. The trees of the forest came right to the edge of the water, or perhaps it would be more correct to say that the swollen river had invaded the skirts of the forest. The trees that overhung the water were fresh with gleaming new leaves. Brightly plumaged birds were shrieking and battling over nesting sites, and that was what drew my eyes upward. I stared at the largest nest I'd ever seen, and then saw a child emerge from it and walk briskly along the limb back toward the trunk. I was gaping, soundless for fear that any shout I raised might cause the child to fall. Big Ida saw the direction of my gaze and lifted a hand in greeting. A man emerged from what I now saw was a tiny hut hung in a tree, and waved before following the child. "Is it a hunter's shelter?" I asked him, and he stared at me as if my words made no sense. Belin was passing by on the deck. No, it's a home. Rainwild folk have to build in the trees. No dry land. They build small and light. Sometimes five or six little rooms hung in the same tree. Safer than one big one. She paced by me, intent on some nautical task, and left me gaping at the village that festooned the trees. I stayed on the deck until early evening, teaching my eyes to find the small clusters of hanging chambers. As the sky darkened, lights began to gleam from some of them, illuminating the flimsy walls so that they glowed like distant lanterns in the treetops. That night, we moored alongside several smaller boats, and folk came down from the trees to ask for gossip and offer small trades. Coffee and sugar were the most sought-after items, and these they traded in small quantities for freshly harvested tree greens that made a refreshing tea, and strings of bright snail shells. Belin made a gift of a shell necklace to Spark, and she expressed such delight over it that the woman actually smiled.
"We're close to Treehog,"
Leftrin told us at the galley table that night.
"Probably past Kasserik tomorrow morning and be in Treehog in the afternoon."
"You won't stop in Kasserik?"
Perseverance asked curiously.
"I thought that's where the dragons hatched."
It was. Leftrin scowled, and then said, And it's the home of traitors, folk who betrayed the trade away and never suffered any consequences for it. People who harboured those who would have slaughtered dragons for their blood and bones and scales. We gave them a chance to redeem themselves and bring justice down on the betrayers. They didn't take it. No dragon trader vessel will ever stop there to trade. Not until Kandral and his cronies are brought to justice.
The colour drained from Spark's face. I wondered how well she had hidden the tiny vial of dragon blood she had pilfered from Shade, or if the fool had used all of it. I had never heard Leftrin speak so vehemently, yet Amber sounded calm and almost cheerful as she said,
I shall be so pleased to see Althea and Brashen again, or perhaps the word I must use now is meet. Would that I could see them again, and Boyo.
Captain Leftrin looked startled for a moment. I'd forgotten you knew them, but in any case, you would not see Boyo. Some years back he went off to serve a term or two on Vivacia, and never returned. Vivacia had a right to demand him, but I know it was a wrench for Althea and Brashen to let him go. But he's a man now, and he has the right to choose his own life. He may wear the Trell name, but from his mother's side, he's a Vestrit, and Vivacia has a right to him, and he to her, though the Pirate Isles may not agree with that. He lowered his voice. Paragon was not pleased to see him go. He demanded that there be an exchange. He wanted to be given his namesake, Paragon Ludluck. He's a Ludluck by right, but I hear in the Pirate Isles they call him Kennetson.
Leftrin scratched a whiskery cheek.
Well, Kennetson is the son of the Queen of the Pirate Isles, and she wasn't willing to let the lad go. Paragon said he'd been cheated. He called it as he saw it, an exchange of hostages, though he was quick to point out that he had a more rightful claim to both men. But Queen Etta of the Pirate Isles simply said no. We even heard a rumour that Kennetson was courting and was likely to wed a wealthy lady from the Spice Isles. Well, Queen Etta had best marry him off soon, if that's what she intends. He's well past the age for it, and if he does wed, then I doubt he will ever sail on Paragon's decks. Paragon becomes moody or disconsolate whenever it is spoken about, so perhaps the fewer questions about Boyo, the better.
I don't understand, I objected softly, though obviously Amber did. Leftrin hesitated.
Ah, well.
He spoke slowly, as if revealing a confidence.
Althea and Brashen captained the Paragon now, but for generations he belonged to the Ludluck family. He was stolen, and for a time the pirate Igrot used him for foul ends. Scuttled and scarred, he somehow managed to find his way back to Abingtown beach. And then he was righted and hauled out to languish on shore for years. Brashen Trell and the Vestrit family claimed Paragon when he was a washed-up hulk. They refitted him and put him out to sea again. But he's a Ludluck ship at heart still, and for a time the pirate Kennet Ludluck reclaimed him and died on Paragon's deck. The ship would want Kennet's son, and Boyo.
And Althea? Amber queried. Had she anything to say about Kennet's son living aboard Paragon?
Leftrin looked at her. I sensed a tale untold, but he said only,
Another discussion that were better not held on Paragon's deck. They no longer call him the Mad Ship, but I would not tempt his temper, or Althea's. They are bound to disagree on some things.
Amber nodded gratefully.
I thank you for your warnings. A careless tongue can do much damage.
It was hard to sleep that night. A different ship and the next leg of our journey loomed before us. I'd be going deeper into territory unknown to me, and taking people little more than children with me. I spoke into the darkness of our cabin. It's in my mind, Perseverance, to ask Captain Leftrin if he might not take you on as a ship's boy. You seem well suited to this trade. What think you of that? Silence followed my words, then his voice came out of the dark, tinged with alarm.
You mean afterward, when we are homeward bound again?
No, I mean tomorrow.
His voice was lower when he said,
"But I vowed my service to you, sir."
"I could release you from that vow, help you set your feet on a brighter and cleaner way than the one I must follow." I heard him draw a long breath.
"You could release me from your service, sir. Indeed, if you chose to turn me out, I could no longer claim to be yours. But only B could release me from the promise I made to avenge her. Turn me out if you wish, sir, but I will still have to follow this to the end."
I heard Lent turn over in his bunk. I had thought him asleep, and his voice was so thick that perhaps he had been. "Don't even bring it up to me," he warned me. "It's as the boy said. I gave a promise to my father, and you can't ask me to break it. We follow you, Fitz, to the end, no matter how bitter." I said nothing, but my mind went to work immediately. What would constitute the end for Lent? Could I convince him that he had done his duty and could honorably return to Buckkeep without me? I did not judge it safe to put Spark and Purr on a ship home without a protector. I could claim I'd had an urgent skill summons from Dutiful for Lent to return home to Shade. By the time he found out it was false, he'd be home. Yes. I pulled up my knees to fit better in the small bunk and closed my eyes. That part, at least, was settled. A small but convincing lie in Bingtown, and I could get at least him onto a ship home. Now I just had to find a way to pry Perseverance loose from me. And Spark. The next day went as Leftrin had predicted it would. The crew began to say their goodbyes to us at breakfast.
"Oh, I shall so miss having you aboard,"
Elise exclaimed to Amber. Belin had left shell earrings next to Spark's plate. The dour deckhand had grown fond of the girl. Purr made the rounds of the various crewmen, making his own farewells. We spent our last hours on the roof of the deckhouse, for the day was almost calm, not chill at all, as long as one's coat was closed. The weather had broken, and there was a stripe of blue sky over the river. We passed the dragon's hatching beach, as Skelly pointed it out to us, and then the treetop city of Kasarik. We did not pause, nor did Leftrin return any of the greetings shouted down to us. In the stretch of river between Kasarik and Treehog, the little hanging dwellings were as thick as apples on a tended tree, and I did not know how he could tell where one settlement ended and the next began. But at some point, the captain began to return the friendly waves of folk from their treetop homes. We began to see floating docks tied up to the tree trunks and small vessels moored to them. There were people out fishing, sitting straddled on the tree trunks that overhung the water and letting their lines drop straight down into the river. Tarman swung wide of them to avoid the dangling lines. I was fascinated by the hanging walkways and the well-travelled branches that functioned as footpaths. Spark sat beside Amber and me, pointing up at the trees and exclaiming over how some children ran heedlessly along a branch she would have thought too narrow to traverse with care.
"Treehog docks are just around the next bend,"
Skelly shouted up at us as she passed by the deckhouse. Big Ida was guiding Tarman in closer to the thickly banked trees. The water ran quieter and shallower, and soon the crew unshipped their poles and began to slow Tarman and then to guide him. It struck me that something felt odd, as if more was at work than merely the crew with their poles. The ship seemed too responsive. When I commented on it, Spark said,
"But Tarman is a live ship. That means he helps the crew get him to where they need to be."
"How?" I was intrigued. She grinned.
"Study his wake the next time we dock for the night."
At my puzzled look, she added,
"And think of a frog's legs kicking."
We rounded the bend, and my first glimpse of Treehog put Tarman's legs out of my mind. It was the oldest of the rain-wild cities. The immense trees that overhung the wide grey river were festooned with bridges, walkways, and homes of all sizes. The swampy, flood-prone land beneath the branches of the ancient forest allowed no permanent dwellings. The city of Treehog was built almost entirely in the branches of the trees that lined the river. Dwellings as big as manor houses were built in the lower, thicker branches. They put me somewhat in mind of the houses of the Mountain Kingdom, where the trees were integral parts of the structures.
but these were not as integrated into their jungle setting. I could as easily believe that some storm had blown a grand home from Pharaoh and deposited it here. They were built of all rich wood with glass windows and looked impossibly grand and massive. I was admiring one that seemed to have been built entirely around the trunk of one immense tree when Skelly said, "That's the Cooper's home, Rain's family." I stared up at the looming structure. Oh, wealth and importance personified. His family had been of the ruling class long before he became a king in Kelsingrar. Old wealth shone by the weathering of the ancient support timbers. I stored that bit of insight. So much useful information that I intended to relay to Buckkeep. When I reached Bingtown, I'd send several messenger birds to Dutiful. What I wished to share would not fit into one message capsule.
Oh, look! Have you ever seen such a thing? He's magnificent!
Perseverance's shout drew my eyes from the tree and down to the long dock ahead of us. A live ship was moored alongside it. Sails furled, he rode placidly at the moorage. The silvery wood of his hull proclaimed this was no ordinary ship. Unlike Tarman, this live ship had a fully carved figurehead. His dark head was bowed over his muscular chest,